Welcome to Life Quest, a program that directs you to subjects and books that will make a difference in your life. A program that will make you think and strengthen your journey of faith in the 21st century. My name is Dwight Lainhoff. Today on Life Quest, I'm talking with Dr. Chris Thurman. He is a psychologist, best-selling author, popular speaker. He's conducted hundreds of seminars for churches and corporations around the country. And today I'm talking with him about his book, which is on its 30th anniversary of a revised and updated edition of The Lies We Believe, Renew Your Mind and Transform Your Life. Dr. Thurman, welcome to LifeQuest.
Well, thank you so much for having me on.
I wanted to ask you this question. In 30 years, have you noted any change in the lies we tell each other, or is it the same old ones?
Well, basically, I think it's the same old ones. I think they have a long shelf life, and mm-hmm. that we keep going back to basically the same core destructive beliefs. But as our world has continued to move forward in time, it's interesting that certain newer false beliefs do start to emerge.
Could you unpack that a little bit and tell us what some of them might be?
Well, as far as the newer ones, I think we're living in a day and age where motivational speakers, for example, are telling us what our itching ears want to hear.
Yeah.
And one of those views is that you can do anything you set your mind to.
Mm-hmm.
That human potential is unlimited.
Oh, yeah.
As if we are God himself and all that. So, to me, that's one of the more recent lies that seems to be taking over is, again, that you can do whatever you want, the sky's the limit. And that, to me, is just a godless, new age kind of view of reality.
And yet there's always been this kind of thing, especially in the States, maybe not, where we admire a person who seems to come across as, he raised himself up by his own bootstraps, he did it on his own, but that's not true, is it?
Well, certainly not true that they raised themselves up by their own bootstraps, because all of us need people along the way. But even, kind of related to that is we tend to kind of think almost too grandiosely about people who achieve great things.
Yeah.
And we kind of attribute to them that they actually were able to achieve they had wanted to in life,
mm-hmm.
as if there were no limits to what they were able to pull off. So, yeah, it's still that kind of unhealthy view of self-made people, as if they did it by themselves and that they reached, kind of human potential and beyond, which nobody does.
Early in your book, you talk about the deadly cost of lies we believe, and you said there's this damaged view of self. In other words, this overly high sense of self. And yet there's this other contrast, just a page later, that we have this often the other extreme, too highly ideas about other people.
Yeah, I think we can be kind of gotten either way on that. We can have too high of a view of ourselves and others, and we can have too low of a view of ourselves and others. So faulty beliefs can be either way. Some people are too full of themselves,
mm-hmm.
and they think they're God's gift to the planet, and other people walk around like they're a waste of humanity, neither of which is true.
And then this section, my worth is determined by how I perform. And that really cuts to the heart of Christian perspective, doesn't it?
It does. I think I would relate this to the issue of shame, and that a lot of us have, all of us really have shame issues to some degree.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the more painful parts of that is equating your worth as a human being to how well or poorly you perform every day, especially morally. And clearly in biblical teachings, we are to anchor our worth in the fact that God fearfully and wonderfully made us in his image. And that's why we have worth.
This idea that we need everybody to think positively about us and everyone's love and approval seems to be exacerbated by social media. Everybody's got to give me a whole bunch of likes on Facebook.
Yeah, I think a lot of us do struggle with that need for approval. I know I do. It's been kind of a lifelong struggle, is wanting everybody to approve of me or like me. And, you know, because not everything about us is likable, we are inevitably going to run into the fact that not everybody thinks we're the cat's meow.
Right.
But, yeah, in this day and age, it's just a real kind of disturbing thing to see how much social media has been fueling people getting approval from people they don't even know, or, you know, trying to just, almost approval can become a god before God if we're not careful.
And then on the opposite side, we kind of strike out at people with silly things. I've retired several times, and I'm working at the local Ace Hardware store, and some lady was unhappy that we didn't have something, and she looked at me and says, "And I don't like your glasses either." I thought, that's very strange.
Well, that to me is another version of shame, is, you know, another face of shame is when people will go after others and attack them and put mm-hmm. them down and demean
yeah.
them. And that's, to me, just another, you know, they've bought into the lie that if they don't feel good about themselves, the way to feel good is to put somebody else down and to denigrate them.
Yeah, and in another section you say, my unhappiness is externally caused, is a life. We this is tied in with what? Not taking responsibility?
It is, yeah. All throughout human history, we've all struggled with this tendency to blame the guy riding our bumper for our anger, or blame somebody for hurting our feelings. And I'm not trying to suggest here that we shouldn't have feelings, because we should, and I'm not talking about not sharing them. I'm
mm-hmm.
talking about the human tendency to blame people for the feeling itself. And so I push people pretty hard, please own your own feelings. If you're angry, just say, I'm angry about the fact that you showed up 20 minutes late. Don't blame them for your anger. That's kind of a cop-out, and that's going to put you in the victim chair.
I'm a parent of four daughters, grown now. But
God bless you.
Exactly. But I can remember at various times during this parental journey that my wife and I thought, you know, everybody else's kids are just, you know, the parents get along with them, and the kids love each other, and it wasn't always that true, as I look back.
Yeah, well, you know, human relationships are challenging, to say the least, and they have a lot of bumps and bruises and wounds. And anytime we have kiddos, we're going to watch them as they slam into each other.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, healthy parenting is trying to help kids learn how to do proper repair work with each other.
Mm.
You know, to properly apologize, to own your actions, to be genuinely sorry when you do something hurtful, and to have empathy for how the other person must have felt, and, you know, really mend that fence and not sweep it under the carpet and move on as if you don't have to ever come back to it.
One of the things I've really found interesting and helpful in your book, The Lies That We Believe, and that is this contrast. On the one hand, we want to take credit for things that perhaps we shouldn't, but then we also look at, others are all more messed up than I am, so why am I so bad?
Yeah, I do think we're walking a tough tightrope there, because we are supposed to, you know, accept and face that we are all messed up. But, you know, we get into trouble when we either look left or right in the following way. If we are not careful, we look at others as being less messed up than us, and that I'm the only one that's kind of especially troubled and have defects and flaws. But the other extreme is I'm far superior to others, and they're much more messed up than me. And again, the enemy doesn't care which extreme he gets you on, because both of them are unhealthy views of people and yourself.
And yet in 2,000 years of Christianity, we're still working on this God's love has to be earned thing. And at the same time, I found people that have been very critical of other people's mistakes and sins, But then when it comes to, we get unhappy when people don't sin like we do. We kind of think that God ignores our disobedience, you're suggesting.
Yeah, I do think there's a combination of lies that we believe about God. Perhaps the deadliest is that his love has to be earned, as if his love is dependent on our behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the characteristics of God is that he is love, and that he doesn't wake up every day wondering whether or not he's going to love us and love us fully. So our behavior actually has nothing to do with the love of God.
Mm.
It is who he is. Now, God does not turn a blind eye to our disobedience, and it's part of his love that he disciplines those whom he loves. So he's not going to be indifferent to when we're messing up. He loves us too much to ignore when we're being hurtful to ourselves or hurtful to others by sinning. So he's that wonderful package of my love is unconditional, but it does express itself in that I will discipline you when you are out of line.
Yeah. If you just tuned in, I'm talking with Dr. Chris Thurman. He's issuing the 30th anniversary edition of his book, The Lies That We Believe. I wanted to ask you, in the title of Chapter 8, The Lies Men Believe, but you give a couple of quotes, and one is from the Scripture, 1 Corinthians 13:11, where St. Paul says, "When I became a man, I put the ways of childhood behind me." Could you tell us what are those ways, those childish ways that we find ourselves in?
Well, I would say one of them is the tendency to not grow up in the sense of not be willing to face problems head on. To stay in little boy mode in that we want others to rescue us from our problems.
Mm-hmm.
And we want them to either be taken care of by others or just go away is a childish way of thinking about life. And I think, not that it's unique to men, but, men and women both, this whole tendency to run from painful things and to not be willing to square up with them, metaphorically not to go up to Goliath and cut his head off,
yeah,
go on to the next problem that's right behind that one.
Mm-hmm.
So that, to me, is one of the more disturbing things about men these days is, we just are running too much from our problems because they're painful, and we're still being little boys who want mommy or daddy to rescue us, and that just really is catastrophically destructive.
And sometimes they go to a counselor or a pastor, and they want them to solve the problems for them.
Yes, I've had more than a few people drop themselves in my office and then want me to wave a magic wand over their head and help them to immediately become mature and healthy and whole. And, you have to lovingly work through that with clients and help them to take some ownership and be willing to roll up their own sleeves.
On page 132 of your book, you say you've probably heard the statement, "The truth will set you free." And it reminded me that I remember reading a work by a psychiatrist who said, "And sometimes the truth can drive you mad."
Mm-hmm.
But you suggest the truth will set you free, but it can also lead to pain and sometimes at first make you miserable.
Yeah, I think if we're not careful, we interpret the truth can set you free that it means it's not going to sting you, and you're just going to be experiencing pleasant emotions all the time. You're going to be happy. But the bottom line to truth is it really is painful at times.
Mm-hmm.
Certain truths are very disturbing, and while it will set you free to accept that truth and embrace it, it's going to have an ouch factor to it. And courageous people are willing to let the truth be painful, and they're willing to, kind of move on from there. But, the truth will set you free, that's for sure, but it does have a cost to it.
Do we sometimes tell too much to too many people?
Yeah, I think we sure can. I think, we can be a little bit too transparent, a little bit too self-disclosing. And so with clients, I'll talk with them about, let's be real wise and discerning
mm-hmm.
about who we're telling what. And let's, the people that are the safest and most trustworthy, let's tell them more. And then the people that are more outside that ring, let's tell them a little bit less. And let's not, kind of open up too much to people that we don't know if we can trust or if they're safe.
And confessions sometimes makes us feel good for the moment, but we don't think about the consequences beyond that.
Yeah, we don't think about consequences two different ways. One, the consequences for us having said it, mm-hmm. and thus it being passed around. And then, if it's a confession to the person involved, we sometimes are a little bit insensitive to how that's going to impact them.
Uh-huh.
And whether or not they might be, hurt or wounded again by what we're saying and even how we brought it up.
In one section, you talk about temptations. In fact, you talked about it from the very beginning of your book. I believe it was Mark Twain that allegedly said, "I can resist everything except temptation."
Mark Twain.
And yet, there it is. It is right there. On the other hand, as a pastor, Dr. Thurman, some of the strangest people I've come across are those that insist, before Jesus comes, I have to be perfect. And they are usually the least perfect.
Yeah, whenever I think about this, I think about the three hats that the enemy wears. He's called the accuser, the mm-hmm. deceiver, which is what my book is about, is his deceiver role,
right.
And the tempter. So in his efforts to kill, steal, and destroy, he will throw temptation our way. And again, that ties back into, if I ever give in to temptation, then I've lost the love of God and maybe even lost my salvation.
Mm-hmm.
So I better be perfect. And
right.
It's like, perfect is a pipe dream. Christ wouldn't have needed to come if you could be perfect in your own strength.
You talk about the Love Never Fails chapter 14, the opposites of that are not always seen as the opposite of love. And you mentioned indifference or aggressive and passive-aggressive. Could you talk about that for a second?
Yeah. Sometimes we don't have a real clear sense of what love really is,
mm-hmm.
specifically what agape love is. And so I go in that chapter into what love isn't, and I break it into a number of different things, three of which come to mind. One is, it's not love when you're being passive or isolating or being indifferent to people. That's not love. Secondly, when you're being aggressive and you're attacking and you're being abusive verbally or physically, that's certainly not love.
Mm-hmm.
And then being passive aggressive is not loving. When you're letting your anger out covertly in ways that hurt people, but it's kind of hidden and covered up. So those are three forms of interacting with people that are not agape love, and therefore we really have to work on agape love is a kind of love that attempts to foster the growth and well-being of the other person. That's the highest kind of love.
When I was reading your book, and I get to chapter 22, and there is this stark title, "You're going to die."
Yeah.
And yet it's dealing with not just that reality, but the whole concept of grief, which isn't just always about death, but is that certainly a part of it. We handle grief in different and not always the most positive ways.
Yeah, I think we do. I think, I think back to my own mother's passing when I was 24,
mm-hmm.
and I didn't grieve that properly. And I think, again, back to emotional pain, we're kind of averse to it, and therefore,
yeah.
if we're not careful, we don't grieve our losses. But in that chapter, I'm just trying to drive home that one of the most important truths of all is that everybody's life has a time limit to it. And if we don't think about that properly, not morbidly, but if we don't just every so often stop to realize, the clock is ticking and I want to live my life in the fullest, best way that I can, and I don't want to walk around in denial that I'm going to die. I don't want to be preoccupied with it in a unhealthy way, but you are going to die should be or can be one of the most liberating truths of all, because then you can really live vibrantly and passionately and in a meaningful way that makes you sleep like a baby at night.
Mm-hmm. Again, the book is The Lies That We Believe by Dr. Chris Thurman. Two things regarding format. One is, at the end of each chapter, you have questions. And then, if you could tell us a bit about the Lies We Believe workbook.
Okay. Well, I wrote The Lies We Believe not knowing if people would do the workbook. So I tried to write the book with a little bit of an emphasis on if people were to read through it in group format.
Okay.
That here are some discussion questions that you guys could do together to go through the book as a group. But as I wrote the book, it was increasingly clear to me that it needed a workbook.
Okay.
That I didn't want people just reading the book and being up in their head. You know, the verse about be doers and not just hearers only.
Yeah.
So I wrote the workbook to where there's a corresponding chapter in the workbook for every chapter in the book that gets you to do more active homework assignment kinds of things so that you can really benefit from what you're reading.
Dr. Thurman, where can our listeners get a copy of your book?
Well, they can get it on, you know, Amazon, and this book is in audio, so some people, I find myself being this way.
Uh-huh.
I get through books faster on audio these days, so they can get it on audio. But Amazon, ChristianBooks.com, just any place like that.
Dr. Thurman, thanks so much for being with us on LifeQuest.
Well, I appreciate you having me. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to LifeQuest today. If you have questions or comments, you may send them to lifequest@lifetalk.net. My name is Dwight Lainhoff. This program comes to you from studios in the Meadowglade Church, Battleground, Washington.